ladies.
Well, that's probably a yearly thing. Her doesn't usually get in.
She's
awesome.
Don't usually,
I suppose. And the girls were in the state tournament, too, and they didn't vote for them. So.
Oh, the girl hockey team?
Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee hearing. Thank you for being here. We're going to continue with the testimony that we began yesterday from interested parties who wish to comment on the governor's budget proposals. We've had hearings in the last couple of weeks on the governor's proposed changes to the budget. We have not had hearings on his bill yet. We're waiting to see the bill, but we do have some idea of what his change proposals are. And we've invited comment from the public on those changes. And so we have a list of testifiers this morning. We're going to, with some minor adjustments, just take them in order that they appear on the list. If you have that copy, that'll be the list we go by. So at this point, I'd like to invite Mr. Rick Varco to come to the table if he is here. Rick Varco? Okay. I understand Mary Regan is going to be here a little bit later, so we're going to move her down the list. I saw Mary Krinke enter the – did she – are you ready, or did you want to – she's ready. Okay. So we'll invite Ms. Krinke to join us at the witness table. Morning. Thank you for being here, and welcome to our committee. Do you have some things that you need to would like to have handed out? One of our pages.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Speaking today on behalf of 147 hospitals and our 17 healthcare systems, there are probably a dozen provisions within the Health and Human Services budget proposed by Governor Dayton that would impact hospitals. When you're a provider as large as hospitals, it's hard to imagine that putting together a budget would not impact hospitals in some way. I have selected four of the items in the governor's proposed budget to share with you today. The first one is the governor's proposal to dramatically increase the hospital surcharge. As you all know, we currently pay a 1.56% surcharge on all hospital revenues with the exception of Medicare services. Medicare services are excluded from the surcharge. The governor has proposed raising that surcharge up to 4.45%. That would raise about $498 million. And in the governor's proposal, he includes a provision to pay back about 44% of that, about $247 million, back to hospitals. But it would leave the hospital community losing about $251 million. This is a surcharge increase of over 185%, and we simply cannot support a surcharge increase of that magnitude. The Hospital Association has been running alternative surcharge proposals, and at some point in time would be willing to come back and share that information if the chair is so interested. But at this point in time, for the record, we are opposed to the governor's proposal of raising the surcharge by over 185%. The second area that I would like to mention are cuts in MRC payments. The MRC payments help support clinic as well as hospital training sites for four professional groups, physicians, advanced practice nurses, dentists, and pharmacists. And it really is important to note that if this money dries up, those clinics and those hospitals are likely to reduce the number of spots that they have in their training programs. And from everything that we have seen, if a healthcare professional is educated in Minnesota, they stay in Minnesota. So we believe this really will impact our next generation generation, our next generation of healthcare providers, if we don't have those spots in our clinical programs. The third area that I want to mention is yet another delay in the hospital inpatient rebasing. Now, for those of you who are familiar with rebasing, it's how the hospital rates get updated. And it's supposed to happen every 2 years. But because of budget problems in the past, the 2009 rebasing was delayed, as well as the 2011. And what happens, it becomes more expensive each time you delay it. And so right now, our inpatient hospital rates are based on 2002 costs minus 14% now. We have another budget cut that goes into effect this July 1st. So starting this July 1st, hospital rates will be at minus 16% off of 2002 costs. So our hospitals, unless they're eligible for one of the DSH payments or add-on payments, they're paying about 50 cents on the dollar of actual costs, not charges, but actual costs. And the last area that I want to mention are cuts that will be associated with hospital readmissions. Now, this is not necessarily a bad proposal in the governor's budget. Let me say that again. Hospitals are committed to working on our readmissions. But this is not going to be easy. This is how we do better care management outside of the hospital setting in order to prevent another admission. And as we move our system to one that is based on quality instead of volume, it's not necessarily going to be easy. Doesn't mean it's the wrong thing to do, but it is harder than it sounds. So I just want the committee to know that this is a lot of work involved with this proposal of the governor's. So those are the four areas that I wanted to share with the committee. The last is just a general comment, and I wish a few more members were here to hear this part, but the Medicaid program is a dollar-for-dollar match. So as you all are setting your targets within your caucus and trying to determine what the budget cut is going to be for this committee, I urge you to talk to your colleagues and remind them that for every dollar you have to cut, in essence, it's $2 out of our healthcare system. So I'm hoping you will divide your budget target in half, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Maybe I should ask you what our target will be, since I don't know it yet, but maybe you do.
I would love for you to ask me what your target should be, Mr. Chairman.
I'd say what it should be, what it will be, I guess, is my question. I did have a couple of questions for you, if you wouldn't mind. There was a comment made yesterday by, I believe, Representative of Regents Hospital, talking about the surcharges as well, that you mentioned them in your earlier remarks. And the comment made had something to do with the size of the surcharges having an impact on the hospital's ability to what he described as drawing down federal dollars.
Yes.
Could you, if you know, could you explain what that structure is about? And I assume that's part of what you're discussing as well.
This is a little into the weeds of hospital financing, but just so you all know, every hospital has what is called an upper payment limit. And we cannot have the Medicaid rate be higher than what Medicare would have paid. So it limits your ability to how much federal match you can bring into the Medicaid program. So what Regents Hospital was referring to is that the size of the governor's surcharge does not allow the hospitals to get any more back into their rates. So that's why we have been modeling surcharge numbers around 3%, quite frankly, that we believe we could still try to make the hospital community whole by leveraging that amount of money back. It's a little complicated, I know, but the size of the governor's surcharge means that the hospitals will not be able to get any more back into their Medicaid rate. It's simply just a way to squeeze more money out of hospitals rather than really enhancing what we can get back in the Medicaid program.
Thank you. And then this handout that you provided for the committee, which shows a list of hospitals. This is the analysis of the governor's proposed surcharges, how they would affect individual hospitals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for reminding me of this. This is a document that has been produced by the Minnesota Hospital Association that is an analysis of the governor's proposal to increase the surcharge from its current 1.56% rate up to 4.45%. And what we have done is the governor's proposal calls for a 24% rate increase in the first year and then an 18% in the second year, and that is the second column. And then the third column is the differential, what every hospital in the state would be paying in increased surcharge amounts.
Thank you. We've asked the department when they were reviewing that proposal to provide this information. We appreciate your providing it. We'll see if they provide us with identical analysis.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, when you say identical, I always hope for similar, just because sometimes our numbers are based on 2008 revenues that we have the information from. The department might have more current or updated information. So similar impact rather than exact impact is probably a better choice.
Duly noted. One other question real quick. You talk about rebasing. The governor is showing some savings by delaying rebasing. Is there any merit to finding savings in what might be called a partial rebasing? Is that something that the hospitals have looked at?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. Because our last rebasing was based on 2002 Medicare cost reports, what happens when rebasing gets delayed, hospitals change services. You might have a hospital that is now providing a very intensive service that they didn't provide before. Also, pockets of poverty change, and so the amount of Medicaid business that one hospital has versus another hospital. And Senator Sharon is not here at the moment, but just I want to share this with you. Mankato Hospital is one of the lowest paid hospitals in the state, and I know that Mankato has seen increases in both poverty, and that hospital has also improved or increased their service areas. So Senator Sharon, I just mentioned that the Mankato Hospital has one of the lowest Medicaid rates in the state. And part of that is because we have had to delay rebasing twice. And I'm confident that if we can move forward with a partial rebasing, that Mankato's rates will be more level to the type of services they are currently providing. And so the rebasing, even if some of the money has to be taken away, the rebasing process itself actually adds fairness to the system. So,
Thank you. I appreciate your coming this morning and appreciate your information. We will be, I'm sure, working with the Hospital Association as we proceed with our budgeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before she leaves.
I'm sorry. Senator Higgins?
Ms. Krinke, come back for a question. Mr. Chair and Ms. Krinke, in listening to your testimony on the surcharge, I had the opinion, or I was left with the opinion, that all hospitals would be negatively affected. But I see there's a handful of hospitals here on the bottom of the list that aren't. And so could you tell us about what's going on with those hospitals?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I would be happy to. The governor's redistribution method or payback method is fairly simplistic. And what I mean by that, they just plopped the money back into the Medicaid rate without any changes in the formula. So hospitals that have the largest amount of Medicaid business receive the largest amount of payback. So that is why Hennepin County Medical Center had the largest amount. Now, what's tricky about this, you take a hospital like Children's Hospital that has a huge amount of Medicaid business, but they're hurt by the surcharge because they have no Medicare business. And Medicare is excluded from the surcharge revenue. So they're having to pay a whole lot in, with even though they're getting some back, they're having to pay a disproportionate amount in, which is why we have some other models that we think will make the distribution flatter. I know this is pretty complicated, committee, but what we would like to propose is an alternative distribution mechanism to reduce the difference between the winners and losers on this list. All we have done here is taken the governor's proposal and modeled what it would do. We believe there are some alternative ways to look at the surcharge, both in terms of a smaller dollar amount surcharge and a different distribution amount. But I don't know what these are probably discussions for a later point in time, and I'm not sure what the committee's disposition is on surcharges overall. But
thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again for being here this morning. Next, we have Ann Henry from the Minnesota Disability Law Center. Welcome to the committee. Please pull the microphone close and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We're part of the Legal Aid Society. And we work with children and adults with long-term significant disabilities, such as intellectual and developmental disabilities, physical disability, spinal cord injury, multiple sclerosis, traumatic brain injury, and mental illnesses for children and adults. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to comment on the governor's budget proposals. We are relieved and grateful that some of those proposals were modified or withdrawn, some that we were very concerned about. But we do have 13 items, and this reflects, I think, the wide scope of people with disabilities and the services they need. But there are 13 items that will negatively affect people or the providers and services that they use in one way or another. And in the short time we have, rather than comment on those, we would like to suggest three considerations for you to keep in mind as you continue this most daunting task of balancing the budget in the face of the catastrophic deficit. The first one was just mentioned by Mary Krinke, and I think, again, it reflects the fact that a lot of the programs in this budget sector are funded with state and federal funding. We are most concerned that we all keep in mind when you cut medical assistance, you have to double the value of that cut to understand the service impact or the fee impact on people with disabilities or providers. And as an example, I would point out the waiver caseloads for the disability home and community waivers. Those programs have been limited starting in 2002, except for 1 year. And although the cut was reduced after the February forecast in the governor's supplemental proposals, the value of that service cut is over $71 million. And that is a program that has thousands of people on the waiting list with developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, mental illnesses. The second point to keep in mind, you have also heard about from a number of people, and that is to consider the cumulative impact of the cuts. You got a stark example of that yesterday from Courage Center. Numbers of the pages affect the same provider and consequently would affect the people with disabilities who need those services. I would offer as another example a concern we have about both the provider rate cut, which has now in the governor's proposal been reduced to 2% for continuing care providers. But if you consider that, which would be a cut to personal care assistance services, PCA, in conjunction with the Medicare crossover cut, which is a complicated proposal but will essentially result in Medicare home care agencies being reduced significantly. We know that a lot of those Medicare home care agencies also provide PCA services, and we're very concerned, especially in rural areas, that they will no longer be able to provide the service to their Medicaid population, to those on medical assistance. And so some folks in rural areas, we're worried, will no longer be able to have access to PCA services to help them remain in their homes. The third consideration is to encourage you to keep on digging to understand the unintended but predictable consequences of these proposals. Of course, they're going to be hard on families and the people themselves in the communities, but we also think that some of these proposals will result in actually costing more than saving the dollars that are cut. And an example here would be the cut to children and community services. This is social service money that counties use, and the cut was reduced to $17 million. However, from the budget page, it looks like the funding is going to be restricted. It's going to be restricted, apparently, to adult and child protection, which, of course, we strongly support. But the money's now also used for adult and children mental health services and also developmental disabilities. And just to try to connect the dots, yesterday you heard from Norm Monk, who had three people that get services from his employment and day service for people with disabilities. A lot of the folks in his program are funded with county dollars. And we're worried about restricting the CCSA funding could lead to adults with developmental disabilities not getting access to day services in various places in the state. And these are adults, this is often the only service they're getting. They're living with families, parents usually, in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, who are able to continue providing all the services and supports and home because they get that day service that's funded by the county. That kind of a cut is simply going to lead more people out of the home. And every month those families can hang on and provide that service is a good thing and helpful, both to the family and to the person with disability in the budget. So with that, I'll conclude and just let you know that we are working with the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. You heard from Chris Bell yesterday. We will be bringing forward proposals to improve self-directed services and to increase care coordination and connection to healthcare homes, which we think will stretch the dollars we have. So thank you.
Thank you for being here. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next we have Chris Etherington, St. Paul Sober Living. Welcome to the committee. Apologize we were not able to get to you yesterday. Appreciate your coming back.
Good morning. My name is Chris Etherington. I'm the owner and executive director of St. Paul Sober Living. We're a 100-bed sober housing company in Minnesota and in Colorado. I asked to speak today, excuse me, when I heard that funding for treatment options in Minnesota may be in jeopardy. I received funding for treatment through the Rule 25 process 12 years ago. I was able to go to inpatient treatment. I finished the treatment in November of 1998 and have remained clean and sober to this day. I live in St. Paul. I own and live in a triplex on the west side, and I lease to two local families. I own a small business, St. Paul Sober Living. I have employees that live and work both in St. Paul and Minneapolis. My primary concern here is that you all that are charged with the task of deciding what funding is made available for chemical dependency treatment in Minnesota are aware of the crucial differences in treatment modalities and the efficacy of each. Not that I am an expert on those, but that we are fortunate to have some incredibly experienced people here in Minnesota that are very well versed in treatment outcomes, what works and what does not for all types of cases. Some of those folks are here today. I urge you all to use your resources to tap these people and to do what you can to understand what it means. For example, to shift patients from inpatient treatment to outpatient treatment. In my personal story, outpatient treatment didn't work, was the wrong modality for me. My company, St. Paul Sober Living, our primary force of what we do with sober living is to create unity among people in early recovery and to give them a place to live outside of where they normally or away from where they've lived in the past, to separate them from the never-ending cycle of lifestyle choices. So when it comes to the details and the difference in the modalities, I think that there's a lot that we all need to understand. Treatment for the... So me having been given a Rule 25 sort of obviously affected my personal life, but also my professional life. And we have helped provided housing for hundreds of men and women in early recovery. And St. Paul Sober Living will celebrate its 10-year anniversary in June, hopefully at one of the local parks here in St. Paul. We have some plans for an event. So I would like to close, I'd like to say treatment for addiction is a very complicated process, and we all know the costs to the cities and state that come from not treating the disease. But the good news is that we have an incredibly vibrant sober community here in the Twin Cities, and I hope that you will all who have your hands on the purse strings can appreciate that we are here, that we want to help, and that we vote. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for being here this morning, Mr. Etherington. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Paul Cassidy, Children's Hospitals. Morning. Welcome to the committee.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm here today on behalf of Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and thank you for your time today.
Could I interrupt and just encourage you to bring the microphone close so we catch your remarks on tape? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Children serves thousands of kids each year. The sickest of sick kids come to Children's from throughout Minnesota and every county throughout our state. Over 50% of Children's beds are occupied by critically ill kids. Children's last year served over 100,000 children in their emergency room alone. I'd like to take my time today to point out that the budget cuts you're addressing today not only are a year-to-year problem, but a year-to-year growing problem for institutions like Children's. We estimate that the administration's budget proposal will impact Children's to the tune of $10.3 million in lost revenue. Beginning in 2003, we've disproportionately absorbed over $78 million in cuts, and we emphasize disproportionate because the majority of these cuts to hospitals impact just a handful of hospitals the most, those hospitals with high Medicaid populations. We estimate that when hospital reimbursement rates get cut, Children's alone absorbs on average over 16% of the overall cuts to hospitals. In 2003, our Medicaid population made up only 26% of our patient population mix. Today, that total has ballooned to over 43%. Just 14 short months ago, Children's supported and contributed over $11 million to the GAMC solution, a solution that did not benefit Children at all. Continuing through the 2010 legislative session, Children's absorbed another $24 million in cuts as a result of last year's budget compromise. Finally, there appears to be also a misperception that Children's and its other pediatric partners benefited from the recent $1 billion federal Medicaid early enrollment program. That is simply not true. Children did not benefit from this new revenue at all. Mr. Chairman and members, we look forward to working with you to find a fair and equitable solution to this budget dilemma in a fashion that does not disproportionately impact just a handful of our state's safety net institutions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Appreciate you being here. Next, we have on the list Karen Ephraim. I see you just have walked in. Are you needing a few minutes, or can you join us at the – thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Dr. Ephraim. Members of the committee, my name is Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of Education Liberty Watch. I will be referring to a PowerPoint that I hope you received in your packets. Yes. And I will speak briefly about four issues. The first one I would like to present is the horrific human cost of fatherless families. As you can see in slide two, fatherlessness is associated with large proportions of suicide, teen chemical dependency, and incarceration. We would therefore recommend that the state do everything it can to promote marriage and intact families, such as not penalizing paternal involvement during the transition off of welfare and getting rid of no-fault divorce. The next big issue is the allocation of resources for the treatment of the mentally ill. Data from the Department of Human Services annual drug utilization report sent to the Federal Center of Medicaid Services contains the startling revelation that $53 million per year is spent on just antipsychotic drugs for those labeled schizophrenic or bipolar. And that's the number one Medicaid drug expenditure in this state. If you add the other psychotropic drugs, that brings us up to $79 million a year. We believe that the use of these drugs has increased both due to the increase of mental screening of children in juvenile justice and foster care that has very questionable scientific validity, as well as the large and corrupting influence of the pharmaceutical industry on the prescribing habits of physicians, and the advocacy efforts of consumer groups such as NAMI, who receive over half their funding from the pharmaceutical industry. These drugs are associated, as I have testified before, with a 25-year shortened lifespan, decreased brain volumes, and very other severe and life-threatening side effects that children are more sensitive to. Given these fatal and dangerous side effects and their stunning lack of effectiveness, their continued use, especially for children, is a medical, ethical, and fiscal crisis of epic proportions. We recommend that you work to get rid of the screening program, which is at least $6.5 million in the children's mental health grants, and that you implement the other safeguards that we have listed. The third major issue I would like to discuss is home visiting. Home visiting programs are very expensive and begin prenatally. The quotes and data that I provide in the slides show that these programs do not decrease child abuse rates, and there is no evidence of improvement of cognitive or social development of the children in them. These programs raise significant consent, data collection, privacy, and Fourth Amendment concerns. We recommend deleting the authorizing language for home visiting, not spending any state funds for these programs, and reallocating federal TANF funds for these programs to something else. Finally, with regard to child care development grants, we oppose their use, especially for parent aware. There is no evidence of effectiveness of early childhood programs in general, but there is no evidence of evidence of academic and emotional harm, and there is no evidence for the effectiveness of quality rating systems for either program quality or child outcomes. We also oppose using these funds for professional development and accreditation, especially from the National Association for the Education of Young Children, due to the controversial materials that they promote, and we oppose efforts by the state to control family, friend, and neighbor care. Therefore, we ask that the approximately $6 million of state money for these grants be cut and the projected $18 million of federal funds for these grants be used for something else. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Appreciate your being here. Thank you. Next on the list, we had Tricia Stark, who informed us yesterday that she had a prior commitment this morning, and if she arrives later, we'll pick up her testimony at the end of our list. But next would be Bob Melson, Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. Mr. Melson. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, glad to see you all today. My name is Bob Melson.
Mr. Melson, could I interrupt for 1 minute, just encourage you to bring the microphone close so we can catch your remarks on tape? Thank you.
Okay. Is that going to work?
I think so.
Okay. My name is Bob Melson. I'm a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, currently in private practice, and I provide some consulting services to different programs. I am here today as a past president of MARCH and I guess past chair of public policy up until March 4th. And I represent the MARCH organization, which represents 300 treatment providers serving more than 52,000 clients in 2009. We have passed out a historical perspective of our legislative impacts on substance abuse rates. I am not sure whether you got it or not yet for sure. Yeah, that looks like it.
Members, you should have a chart in your packet
and,
of materials.
And the governor's budget also recognizes that we have had a long history of having our rates either frozen or cut. And so we appreciate the fact that he did not, in his budget proposal, recommend cutting rates, because we also believe that it would have a really detrimental effect on programs of low census, especially in outstate Minnesota, that would create the need for people to travel further. Inpatient treatment is a required option for some people. There's no ifs, ands, or doubts about that whatsoever in my mind. But the closer you can have treatment available, it increases the family involvement. And so that's one of the things we're concerned about. Just recently, I found out that two providers, one of which has been serving clients for 30 years on the VA campus, and another one will be closing their doors within the month. And this is really a consequence of rate cuts. So we are grateful that the governor recognized the historical rate problem that we've been suffering through. He accurately understands that further cuts will in all likelihood drastically impact the sustainability of the essential provider structure. The governor's proposal to tighten CD placement criteria is a creative way. However, the national standards that were adopted by Minnesota, ASAM, are pretty clearly clinical guidelines that encourage people to get the right treatment in the right amount at the right time. This is kind of an example of making clinical decisions based on money. And I don't know if that's something that we actually want to go down that road. There are an awful lot of chronic, long-term diseases. In fact, most of the ones that are costing our society a lot of money, things like diabetes and high blood pressure and those kind of things, that create setting clinical guidelines by the budget doesn't seem to make sense to me. In addition, we fear the proposal to increase the county's contribution will have a detrimental effect on county placements. They continue to be the gatekeepers for placement in different treatment programs and will continue to be the gatekeeper even after the state contracting goes through the 1st of July. And counties are strapped also. And so putting that burden extra on there, there are counties across the state of Minnesota who have been unwilling to make placements clinically because they were told, gee, we just don't have the money. That's fine. However, I also passed out a brief, it's got color on it, and it talks about the savings that chemical dependency generates. Chemical dependency generates, for every $100,000 spent on treatment, $700,000 of crime costs and $487,000 of health care costs was shown to be avoided. And I believe that study took into account three or four different states. Chemical dependency does not just go away, the disease or the people. I would encourage you to think about that. You're probably going to pay for this one way or another. The most efficient way to pay for it is to provide treatment for people so that they can be in recovery, not breaking the law, supporting their families. A statistic that Mark Casagrande prepared for me, 1 in 3 families are impacted by addiction. I read a statistic not very long ago that every chemically dependent person affects 10 other people. You'll have to search your memories to see if you've been affected on the job, in your own family, on the roads of Minnesota, wherever, to see if you've been impacted. Chemical dependency affects 100% of the people of the state of Minnesota. It's really important. It leads to huge health care costs. It's a precursor to a lot of the other chronic diseases. We'd encourage you to keep that in mind as you go forward with the budget setting.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Melson. Thanks for being here this morning. Next, we would invite Sarah Anderson, Key Medical Supply.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, and I would invite you to introduce yourself. You have a.
My name is Sarah Anderson, and I'm with Key Medical Supply. And this is the chairman of our industry association, Al Newman.
Hi, my name is Al Newman. I represent MAMES, which stands for Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Suppliers. We're a 7-state organization with over 44 member companies in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to respond to the governor's cut to basic care, which our industry is included in. We take care of some of the most vulnerable and chronically ill people in the state of Minnesota, keep them in their homes and nursing homes. I brought an example of what's happened to my industry over the last several years, and this is a can of, it's called enteral formula. It keeps people alive. It's either fed, we put it in a bag, hangs on an IV pump, or an IV pole goes through a pump, and is either fed through a tube into somebody's throat or in their side. A couple of years ago, my reimbursement on this was about $6.24. The current administration at that time says, well, we're paying way too much money for our medical equipment and supplies. And so we took about a 20% hit at that time. Less than 12 months later, the federal government came out with a 9.5% cut across the board, which included all our medical supplies, enteral, incontinence, you name it, oxygen, hospital beds. And again, a few short months later, the governor added 4.5% to that. So what impact has that had? I mean, you talk about any industry in the state of Minnesota that has given up a lot. We've given up a lot. From 2008 to 2010, the revenue spent by the state's flatline, obvious for obvious reasons, the cost to take care of people in my industry has went down from $19 and some cents today to $17. But at what cost to my industry? There are no more mom and pops. Rural Minnesota used to have drug stores that did this. They can't afford to do it. We talked about, at that point in time, you guys don't realize, but you set precedents for our insurance payers. Blue Cross Blue Shield, following your lead last year, cut us 19.5%. I bet they did not share that cost savings with any of the state and the people that they manage. We help keep people out of hospitals and expensive long-term care stays. We're part of the solution to the health care problem that you guys are facing today. Over the last 2 years, we've had a 15% reduction in jobs with companies going out of business, and we have had to reduce jobs in our own businesses. If you want to add that up, it's about $20 million in taxable payroll loss, in addition to people, you know, people can't find jobs, they've lost their homes and everything. I'm asking you to consider us when you talk about basic care services and the 3% we cannot sustain across the board cuts. During this time period, to our urging, we have urged the federal government to implement accreditation for people in our industry. We pay $50,000 surety bond in each one of our locations. This helps weed out fraud and abuse, make sure that you've got good players. The state has yet to adopt this. You must adopt this to take care of the other players in the state. Moving forward, I'm just asking you, if you need to take money from us, let us come to the table, because we've got to tell you where you can take blood. We can't sustain across-the-board cuts anymore. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Newman, for being here this morning to testify, and we certainly would welcome any input or suggestions that you may have that you refer to, some other approaches, anything you have that would be of interest, please let us know.
We would greatly appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Next, we have Susan Wingert, Pediatric Home Services. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I believe you're each getting handouts right now. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. My name is actually Cameo Zender, but I am here representing Pediatric Home Service. We are also a basic care services provider, providing durable medical equipment, home infusion therapy, and extended hours of nursing to medically fragile children in their homes. Our owner is Susan Wingert. She's unable to testify with you today. She is actually in some key meetings closely monitoring the launch of our newest business line, which is the extended hours of nursing care. I am here, counterparts with Mr. Newman and Ms. Anderson, asking for your consideration regarding the proposed cut to the basic care services reimbursement. Companies like PHS cannot continue to absorb these budget cuts. We have continued to do that over years and years in the past, and what is occurring now is that we as providers are either being forced to close down entire business lines. For example, in pediatric service, we may be forced to reconsider our extended hours of nursing care. Other businesses have not even been as fortunate and have been forced to close their doors altogether. What this means to the state of Minnesota is increased costs to our healthcare programs, decreased access to the vulnerable population of our state, as well as the loss of potential job opportunities to our citizens. What I'd like to first illustrate for you is the cost savings associated with home care services. There are two examples provided to you. One is in the provision of home IV antibiotic therapy. And if you have an opportunity to look at that, you can see that through home care services, we can provide home IV antibiotic therapy. This would include the medication, the nursing care to administer the medication, as well as the necessary supplies for approximately $450 per day. The alternate setting to that type of care is the hospital. Again, looking at that same level of service, including the medication, the supplies, and the nursing, that would be a cost of approximately $2,200 per day. I think even more drastic is the example of ventilatory care. PHS provides ventilatory care to hundreds of patients across the state of Minnesota. We are able to do that for a cost of approximately $1,100 a day. Again, this is the comprehensive support required by that patient, their medical equipment, their supplies, and again, their extended hours of nursing care. Here again, the alternate for those children is a hospital setting. That hospital setting will cost various payers, including the Minnesota Healthcare Programs, approximately $7,000 per day. We ask that you recognize the cost-effective and quality service we can provide to this vulnerable population. Again, as providers trim their business lines or simply go out of business altogether, it is not only the state or the healthcare programs that suffer, it's also those patients. They lose access to those necessary services that keep them at home. They're forced to go into the hospital or potentially into some form of institutionalized care. Finally, I would like to speak to you about the opportunity we provide to create jobs in the state of Minnesota. As we grow our newest business line, the extended hours of nursing care, we are poised to hire approximately 150 nurses and other support staff yet this year. However, if we have to consider how to absorb further budget cuts, we won't be growing our business. We will be struggling to survive. That will mean certainly hiring freezes and most likely layoffs of currently employed citizens of the state of Minnesota. So again, please, we ask you to recognize the service that we can offer, the savings that we can provide as you consider the budgets to the Health and Human Services.
Thank you for being here this morning, and sorry that we couldn't hear Ms. Wingert, but glad that you're here in her place. Appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Next, we have Dr. Catherine Solheim, Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. Dr. Solheim, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Mr. Chair and members. My name is Catherine Solheim, and I'm a faculty member at the University of Minnesota. I'm going to shift our focus just a little bit from mental and physical health to financial health, but recognizing that all three are intricately entwined. I'm here to support the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota program because of the value for the people of Minnesota. This program is slated for a full funding elimination in the governor's budget. As a researcher who has evaluated FAME's effectiveness over the past 10 years, I believe that the FAME is a wise use of state funds due to the program's solid return on investments, its statewide impact, and its successful one-to-one leveraging of federal dollars. FAME was established by the Minnesota Legislature in 1998 to help working poor households save money to build financial assets. And I might mention that this was one of those rare bipartisan efforts that included co-authors from this committee, Senators Berglund and Higgins, and then Representative Pawlenty. To qualify for FAME, household income must fall below 200% of the poverty level, which is about $37,000 for a family of three. I describe these folks as people who are playing by the rules but just can't seem to get ahead. One health setback, a car breakdown, or a temporary job layoff can quickly plunge them into debt and financial crisis. Assets, however, serve as a safety net. In difficult times, we can draw on their value to weather the storm. We have a one-page fact sheet that I would like to share with you, if you'd be willing to, thank you very much. After enrolling in FAME, program participants save and receive a 3-to-1 match for their savings to purchase a home, pursue post-secondary education, or capitalize a small business. All participants complete 12 hours of financial education and receive personal coaching to deal with financial issues that hinder saving. A statewide multi-site collaborative runs FAME, and the partners include Bremer Bank, City-County Federal Credit Union, Women Venture, Leech Lake Tribal Government, Emerge, and community action agencies across Minnesota. FAME works. Over the past decade, FAME participants saved over $2.5 million and have acquired over 1,500 assets. 29% purchased homes, 33% capitalized businesses, and 38% pursued higher education. Data indicate that FAME's financial education and coping help people get a handle on their finances, develop good financial habits, reduce debt, repair and improve their credit, and get connected to mainstream financial services. They develop critical financial habits that lead to long-term economic self-sufficiency. A study I conducted in 2008 demonstrated that 91 out of 97 FAME participants who purchased homes between 2000 and 2004 had retained their homes or sold their property with a net gain. Only 3 homes went into foreclosure, an impressive outcome given participants' financial vulnerability and the challenging economic times. Minnesota communities also benefit from FAME. The assets obtained result in increased property taxes generated from home purchases, jobs created, professional skills attained, and small business purchases that support local economies across the state. FAME's current appropriation is $500,000 for the fiscal year 2010-2011 biennium, which is leveraged to draw down a federal match from the Assets for Independence program. These federal funds will be lost without the match support provided by current state funding. $500,000 in federal match will be lost without this match support. I realize that you are faced with extremely difficult decisions this session. Nonetheless, I urge you to continue state support for FAME as a very low financial investment in the near term that moves working poor families into the financial mainstream. The minimal investment needed to keep FAME alive will reap significant long-term dividends for the economic health of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Solheim.
Mr. Chair, one quick question. Dr. Solheim, it says at the bottom the federal match of $500,000. Is that the match we're eligible for as long as we put $500,000 in, or is it if we put – and we're not likely to do this, I understand, but if we were put $1 million or $2 million in, does the match grow,
yes,
or is it capped at that?
Yes, it could grow.
Dr. Solheim.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator Marty, it can grow. And, in fact, we have waiting lists across the state. So if we could, it would benefit us to bring down those federal dollars.
Dr. Solheim, one other question related to that. If we spent less than $500,000, would the match be whatever we contributed to this, or is $500,000 the minimal amount that we would have to contribute?
Mr. Chair, it is a one-to-one match, so whatever we are able to provide, then they will be able to draw that. Generally.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I had forgotten that it had been so many years ago. I know it was in my first term in the legislature that Senator Berglund and Representative at that time, Pawlenty, and I worked so hard to get this bill passed. The money is for only 3 purposes. It's for buying a house, starting a business, or for higher education. And it's very targeted, and the families work so hard to get the money that they put in so that it can be matched. And it's a great opportunity for people. And I still think we were very forward-thinking in doing this all those years ago, and I would really recommend that we continue to do it.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Solheim, for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Next, we have Eddie Marcus, Basic Human Rights for All. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Marcus.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, to the committee. I want to thank you so very much for giving me this opportunity. My name is Eddie Marcus, and I'm a spokesman and advocate for basic human rights for all people. My motto is, "Thy will be done on earth as it is done in heaven." In responding to the governor's budget and considering all the testimony that has been delivered here today, I'm tempted to ask the question, are there any individuals in this country, in this city, in this state, or in this room who would be satisfied with being sick and having inadequate health care? Would you resist health care? Are there any amongst us? Are there any amongst us wanting education to better ourselves that would resist it? Are there any amongst us having an opportunity for a career of choice that would resist it? Are there any amongst us that would resist peace, prosperity, and joy? Ladies and gentlemen, I perceive a resounding no. None amongst us. Everybody wants peace, prosperity, and joy, including education, health care, and a career of choice. All for obvious reasons. But 30 years of surveying, every single person wanted this. Not one statement of anyone wanting pain, prosperity, and conflict, or lack of sufficient education or health care, a lack of jobs. Next, my question was to politicians, including the United Nations, U.S. presidents, governors, congresses, state legislators, mayors, city councils, and aldermen. Many refused to respond, but for those that did, the question is, do you have solutions or proposals or a plan that would meet the needs and desires of the people, such as those made here today? I received an unequivocal no. In fact, for those that did respond, their justification is they don't believe in it. This led to another question for the general public and organizations that are funded by government, private grants and donations, etc. Considering what you want and the representatives you've elected, their inability to meet your wants and desires, why are they in office? Like the politicians and others, they too did not believe it could happen. They have been taught in schools, in society at large, and the religious community that it could not happen. To try it only means that our nation will be reduced to a level less than or equal to socialist and communist nations that failed. Or at best, if the citizens are good, they might receive life after they die and go to heaven. However, no one can confirm such. Nevertheless, we convince ourselves as a means to justify our inaction here today. I want you to know that there are some people that not only believe, they know it can happen. They are doing everything they possibly can to educate the public and politicians alike of the effort. They have the technological advances and compassion to meet the dreams and aspirations of every citizen, as described here. However, the powers that be are successfully squashing the effort. The way things are benefit a lot of people, and they will not take a chance on system change. In order for this to happen, it requires the people to dream, to believe in themselves, to choose politicians that dream and believe in such necessary system change, and together are willing to make it happen by empowering all that desire change, have been at the drawing boards for decades planning the future for a great state, a great nation, pleasing to all. Now, everyone has a legitimate excuse, similar to that of people born near the equator. Their skin color is dark due to the proximity of the sun. That is a reality. We have all been born in this system, and what it is our reality. People don't have choice in skin color, but they do have choice in standards of living. This, they, and we can change. This budget proposal by the governor, included suggested changes by the legislature, do nothing to deliver satisfaction to the people. And the people deserve to be satisfied. Let me say that again. The people of this state deserve to be satisfied. Now, I know, the people know, and you legislators know that to satisfy the concerns of the people requires system change. And as spokesman and advocate of basic human rights for all, I propose that this committee take every action to allow nothing less than adequate funding to those dependent on it and begin taking necessary action to institute required system change to make peace, prosperity, and joy, including education, health care, and careers of choice, a way of life for all Minnesotans. Now I'm ready for your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Marcus. Apparently, we have no questions at this time. We may have questions later, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Ken Zeichen, AARP. Watching the committee, Mr. Zeichen. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I am Ken Zeichen, a volunteer from Rochester, a volunteer for AARP from Rochester, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today about the governor's budget proposal and some of the potential effects on older Minnesotans and their families. AARP is a nonpartisan statewide organization concerned with helping older Minnesotans age with dignity. We recognize the daunting task before you as you work to find a balanced solution to the budget dilemma, one that minimizes the impact on our most vulnerable citizens. First of all, AARP appreciates that the governor's budget proposal maintains Minnesota's nursing home equalization rate. For many years, this law has protected nursing home residents from discrimination in care. A repeal of rate equalization would result in an unfair burden on those who have saved throughout their working lives and are paying their own way in nursing homes. Repealing rate equalization does nothing to help the state's budget dilemma. It actually increases costs to the medical assistance program by prematurely forcing more private pay residents onto public assistance sooner. We urge you to oppose proposals to eliminate rate equalization. AARP also urges you to prioritize funding for home and community-based services. The governor originally proposed a 4.5% cut, which was recently reduced to 2%. Any cut that comes now will be in addition to a 2.58% cut in the last biennium. It is important to remember that cuts in home and community-based services could force more elderly Minnesotans prematurely into more expensive nursing home care. On average, these Minnesotans can be served in a home or community-based setting for the cost of serving one nursing home resident, actually reducing expenditures to the state. Let me repeat that statement one more time. On average, three Minnesotans can be served in a home or community-based setting for the cost of serving one nursing home resident, actually reducing expenditures for the state. This is a cost-effective program. Plus, receiving care at home as they age and need help is what Minnesotans overwhelmingly want. Our goal should be to help Minnesotans receive appropriate level of long-term care that meets their needs and preferences in the most cost-effective way. Cuts to home and community-based services offset any initial savings by increasing future costs to the state medical assistance program through heavier nursing home usage. AARP is also pleased that the governor reduced his proposal across the board 2% cut in reimbursement rates to nursing homes to a 1% cut. It is important to remember that our nursing home workers are already significantly underpaid, and we must have quality staffing if we want quality care for our loved ones. AARP understands the magnitude of the budget dilemma and the enormity of the task at hand. We are confident that by working together, we can find a balanced approach that minimizes the cuts to services, that help keep seniors and persons with disabilities in their homes, in communities, and in quality nursing homes. AARP looks forward to working with you throughout the process to ensure that our most vulnerable can receive a quality care with dignity. Thank you again for an opportunity to speak to this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Zeichen, for being here this morning. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Kurt Ratson. ARC. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ratson.
Thank you so much for having me and the opportunity to speak to you all. So nice to see all of you this morning. My name is Kurt Ratson. I'm a self-advocate, and I work with the ARC of Minnesota for persons with disabilities. I have cerebral palsy, and I can show you later if you don't believe me. I was born this way, and none of us with disabilities have asked to be this way. We didn't choose to be this way, but we are. I'm here today not only for myself, but for many, many, many others who are much worse off than myself, asking you all not to cut the funding for persons to support services with disabilities. We have seen our share and don't and can't, absolutely can't take any more cuts. Please, as you all think about this, I ask you to think about what's really important here. What's really important here and in the state of Minnesota. Get back to that. Get back to the basics. What's really, really important here. Just think if you had to depend on funding and it gets cut, how would that make you feel? If you needed funding for these programs, not wanting it, that's way down the road. We don't want it. We need it. And some people worse than others. So ask yourself, how would that make me feel, you personally? Thank you so much for your time and for listening to me.
Thank you for coming this morning, Mr. Rutson. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
We now have Alexis Scott. Chrysalis at Tubman.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us, Ms. Scott. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. I am a licensed alcohol and drug counselor at Chrysalis at Tubman. And for those of you who don't know, Tubman has been a domestic violence shelter in Minneapolis for, well, all over the Twin Cities for a very long time. And Chrysalis is the behavioral health section. We treat...
Ms. Scott, could I interrupt you for 1 second? I ask you to bring the microphone close and
sure.
So we can make sure we get your comments on tape.
Thank you. So we treat women at Chrysalis, and it's an outpatient facility. I also am going to be 15 years clean and sober on this Thursday. And I was lucky enough my family was able to send me to treatment. Not one time, not two times, not three times, but four times. And I'm very fortunate that they were able to do that. So I guess as a counselor, I would say that probably 60%, and that's conservative, of our clients are Rule 25. And of those, I have 12 people in a group, and A large number of those have to be referred to a higher level of care, meaning inpatient. It's at the beginning, of course, we try to meet them where they are. One size does not fit all in terms of treatment. Research has shown that. And when women don't get the treatment that they need, it creates all kinds of other burdens. And this includes, it's generational. They end up being involved with CPS, with foster care. There's domestic violence. And then, of course, those things that are not, you know, gender-specific, which are, jail, hospitals. And so really getting the treatment we need and meeting these clients where they need their treatment is a preventative action. And I think you've probably already heard the statistic. I didn't get to have any statistics because I didn't know I was going to do this. But it's every $1 that's spent in treatment is $12 that's not spent in jails and hospitals. Addiction is not a choice, and whether you believe it's a disease or a disorder, whatever you believe, it still needs to be treated, and research shows that treatment works. So also in looking at the ASAM scale for treatment, even though I'm an outpatient counselor, I have to be able to refer my clients to a higher level of care if they need it. We do our best, but there's people who cannot get clean and sober without it. And believe me, a lot of these mothers, they don't want to leave their children to go to inpatient. It takes a lot of convincing a lot of the time. But the streets, especially the homelessness, everything is working against them when you have an addiction problem. And if you believe that addiction is social, physiological, and psychological, that's the kind of treatment, the social part, that they're going to have to be taken out of their current circumstances. It's very hard for somebody to get clean if they're homeless and coming to treatment at Chrysalis. I mean, and they've got three kids running around too. So I know you have very hard decisions to make. Everybody needs everything. And wanted to speak as an advocate for the clients that I see every day who are working so hard. They didn't choose this either. And to change the treatment that's available to them, for me to not have the option to refer them to inpatient is just like saying I can't, I'm going to give somebody with a brain tumor an aspirin. I mean, it does nothing. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Scott, for being here this morning. Appreciate your testimony, and congratulations on your recovery. Thank you. Next, Mary Regan was on our list earlier, and she's available now, so please join us. Welcome
Thank
to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. And I'm not going to repeat testimony you've heard from others. I'm hoping to just talk briefly about three areas that I don't think you've heard too much about. But before I do that, I want to correct a perception that I think was left by Dr. Ephraim related to NAMI, and that is that I can't speak for NAMI National, but NAMI Minnesota receives less than 10% of its funding from pharmaceutical companies. The areas that I want to talk about quickly, CCSA, Children's Community Services Act fund that was created in 2003 by combining 15 grants. At the time, $20 million was taken from Children's Services, and since that time, the grant itself has been reduced by 40%. In the governor's revised budget, he is reducing the appropriation by $5 million versus $22 million in the original proposal, so we're pleased about that. He's also dedicating the remaining funding to child and adult protection, which we do think is appropriate. There are lots of concerns about the growing gap around the state in child protection services. Counties are stretched very thin, and any cuts in these funds could be very difficult for them to replace. And these are the only state dollars that you have in child protection in Minnesota. Minnesota is at the bottom of all of the states in the country in the percentage of state dollars that we put into child protection. The other area of concern is regarding the significant increases in licensing fees. Our providers range from small group homes with 4 beds to a large facility with 103 beds. The small group home today pays $400 for a license fee. Under this proposal, they'll pay $1,000, so a significant increase. In addition, all of these facilities will be charged $20 in background checks. So this all adds up. On average, our larger programs do 90 background checks in a year. The other issue with this is that, once again, we're leaving money on the table. By shifting this cost to providers, we are going to leave $350,000 of federal money that matches the state money on the table. So providers will have to actually pay $1 million for something that the general fund is only paying $650,000 for now. So that's a concern. And then the third point, in the governor's revised budget, there's an appropriation of $5.4 million, I believe, for something called North Star. We don't have the details on this, but I would ask you to pay particular attention when we do get them. 2 years ago, there was a proposal in the governor's budget, which was called North Star Care for Children. And the idea behind the proposal was to increase rates for adoption to be comparable to rates for foster care, which is a wonderful idea. However, it was done by taking money from children in foster care with the highest needs and giving it to children who could be adopted. And this doesn't work. This is not the way to do it, and we're concerned that the proposal may look similar. So we hope that you'll pay attention, and we'll certainly be back to talk about it if it does. So thank you very much.
Thank you for coming here this morning, Ms. Regan. I'm going to ask again if Mr. Rick Varco is here. He was on our list earlier, and he's here and would like to testify. Seeing anyone raising their hand, we do have a few minutes left. I would like to invite anyone who is here that is not on the list that would like to offer comment. Please step forward and identify yourself. Thank you for joining us. If you'd please, for the record, identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Dan Kane, C-A-I-N. I operate a social service program called RS Eden. Provides services in substance abuse, corrections, housing, a number of different areas. I'm also a former heroin addict and ex-convict. Next month will mark 39 years from when I got out of prison. I was in treatment 6 times. And last year, between my family, my children, my wife, and myself, between property taxes, income taxes, sales taxes, I roughly covered 2 of your salaries. People can and do recover, but not everybody goes through the same type of treatment and gets the same kind of outcome. Now, hearing all the people here today talk about please don't cut my services, to me seems a little bit Pollyannish, if you will, because you're going to have to make cuts and they're going to impact on all of us. And in fact, testifying on the governor's budget is probably certainly not a waste of time, but only a preliminary move, because in all likelihood your cuts are going to be worse than the governor's budget. But what you're faced with is you're faced with limited knowledge about where to make cuts. And being that we just had an election, you have new people in commissioners' positions and other positions that probably also have limited knowledge about where cuts can be made. And minus absent knowledge, what you all have to do is you have to limit access. You know, you cut with a meat cleaver instead of a scalpel. Now, you're going to make cuts in substance abuse treatment. There's no question about that. But I would recommend that before you make any cuts that impact on access or impact on vulnerable people, you look at the bureaucracy that's been put in place to govern treatment. You know, we currently have about 20% of the dollars that used to go for treatment going into an assessment, independent assessment process that takes place before a person can even go to treatment. It's a slowdown process. It generally takes people a couple weeks to go through the assessment and then ultimately access a program, which runs counter to treatment because when people are ready, you want to strike while the iron's hot. But nonetheless, once the person gets to the program, another assessment needs to be done. You know, so you have an hour assessment by a non-clinician and then an assessment that has to be done within the first 24 hours by clinicians in the treatment program. Eliminating that duplication would save a considerable amount of money. You also have the situation, I know residential programs are on the line here, but residential programs need to be licensed by both the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. You know, that basically means that the same things get looked at by two groups that don't talk to each other. We're in a position where some of us are licensed or certified by JCAHO or CARF, so we actually have four people that don't talk to each other that basically collect the same information. You know, that's a waste of time. There are multiple areas where you can cut that don't impact on the vulnerable. I would urge you to put together some type of task force of people that have been around this system for 30, 40 years and seen it grow. I mean, we currently have a requirement now where counselors have to spend 25% of their time treating paper. And I can tell you that a lot of that paper is worthless. You know, there are places to save money, but it's not in access to service. It's not in limiting the choices that people have to get the appropriate treatment that they need. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kane, for your candor and your comments this morning. I appreciate very much your own success at dealing with addictions. I lost a very close family member who did not survive that struggle. And I think many of us have friends or maybe family members that have gone through it, and we all appreciate the difficulty and that some people don't make it. I appreciate that very much. I appreciate your comments about trying to find ways to do this that are sensible, and we will do the best we can. I think some of the things that you're talking about, creating task forces, and I think these are things that we need to do. We may not have the luxury of time to permit us to do that before we need to produce a budget or to pass a budget, but I would like to think that going forward and certainly in the interim and next year that we can spend more time at looking at bringing about reform to some of the things that you're talking about that may be duplications or procedures that over time have grown up that may not be very useful. And so I appreciate your comment and be happy to work with you and others on this issue going forward.
Thank you.
Members, I don't have any further testifiers on the list. We are out of time. I do want to. We do have a meeting scheduled tomorrow. We are a little uncertain about what the agenda is going to be. We may have an informational hearing only on the exchange issue that has been brought up by a number of folks. It's something that we will probably have to look at in some way. We don't have a bill, but we may have some information to talk about the health insurance exchange proposal. We may, in addition, have some bills that we will hear as well. So we're trying to finalize that, but we will plan to meet tomorrow morning. So thank you, and we are adjourned.